In part by Euromart International Food Store on Springfield and Locust in Champaign, offering Baltic bakery bread, caviar, and baklava. The Euromart hosts a cheese and olive tasting from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Coming up, an interview from the archives. This interview conducted on January 23rd of this year. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. U.S. Supreme Court Justice Robert H. Jackson was a friend and confidant of President Franklin Roosevelt. In the early 1950s, Jackson began writing a memoir of the president, but he didn't complete it before his death in 1954. A couple of years ago, the manuscript was discovered or rediscovered by law professor John Q. Barrett. He found the manuscript among Jackson's papers while researching a biography of the jurist. He edited the material, and the result is the book That Man, an Insider's Portrait of Franklin D. Roosevelt. John Barrett is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the local dialing area, use the toll-free number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. John Barrett is professor of law at St. John's University in New York. He's also a fellow at the Robert H. Jackson Center in Jamestown, New York. He formerly served in the office of independent counsel Lawrence Walsh during the Iran-Contra investigation. That Man, an Insider's Portrait of Franklin D. Roosevelt is published by Oxford University Press. Listeners, again, I look forward to your questions and comments. The number's 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. John Barrett, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste. It's a pleasure.
Oh, it's a pleasure reading this book.
Well, that's sort of how I felt the first time I learned about it and was handed a folder that said Roosevelt Book.
Gosh.
And it was filled with a jumble of papers, some handwritten, some typed, that really nobody had looked at for 50 years, and the world didn't know about at all. And figuring out that it was an unknown memoir of FDR by Justice Jackson, a fabulous writer and somebody who had an extremely close relationship with Roosevelt, meant that it was a real treasure.
Yeah. The foreword for this book was written by Roosevelt biographer William Lichtenberg. It begins, Robert Jackson is the most important public figure of the 20th century no one has ever heard of. Then he says, that's hyperbole. Historians, of course, know him. But the vast majority of Americans today probably do not. And as you note, then, in your introduction, which follows, FDR needs no introduction. And at one time, neither did Robert H. Jackson. His accomplishments were many. What would you like to say at the outset about who Robert H. Jackson was?
Well, Robert Jackson came to be a figure, a really large figure, on not just the national stage in this country, but the international stage. He went from a farm boy childhood in western New York State, much like Abraham Lincoln, I must say, about 80-some years later, through apprenticeship to a career in the law, to involvement in politics. His was of the Democratic type, and an early acquaintance with Franklin Roosevelt. And as Roosevelt rose higher and went to the White House, he brought Jackson to Washington. And in 7 years, Jackson marches up the ladder in a really dizzying way. He begins as the general counsel in the Bureau of Internal Revenue, today's IRS. He there prosecutes the biggest case in the nation in 1935, a tax case against Andrew Mellon, who had been the Secretary of Treasury under Roosevelt's predecessors. Jackson then goes over to the Justice Department, and he heads the Tax Division, then the Antitrust Division, then he's Solicitor General of the United States, and an incredibly skilled advocate in the Supreme Court, and he really wins the constitutionality of the New Deal in 1938-1939. He becomes Attorney General in 1940. In 1941, he goes on to the Supreme Court, and in 1945, he goes to Nuremberg and is the architect and chief American prosecutor of the principal surviving Nazi leaders. All of that before he's 55 years old.
Remarkable.
It is remarkable. He returns to the court, and then, as was all too frequent in those days, he died young of a heart attack at age 62 in 1954.
Yeah. Of the nation's capital, he described it as a place of heat and dither, and he called it the crony capital. He was a political animal, yet he was not a political animal.
Yeah, there was always a certain reluctance. Jackson numerous times came to the fork in the road where he could have left the law and himself become a candidate. At one point, Roosevelt really thought Jackson was the right person to succeed Roosevelt as president of the United States and tried to orchestrate Jackson becoming governor of New York in 1938, which would have positioned him to be the Democratic presidential nominee in 1940. But Jackson, for all the politics that definitely was his world and his colleagues, was a lawyer and was a guy who had practiced law privately and then in the government in a very hands-on way. And the sort of intellectual challenge, the social significance, the craft and skill of the law was just much closer to his core temperament than politics. So he watched, he kibitzed, he assisted, but he himself was never a candidate, ever.
Mm. You note he was born and reared in Republican territory, but he was a dedicated advocate of the New Deal. How did his political views, liberal and Democrat, develop?
Well, they were somewhat inherited. His pioneer forebears were Democrats. They were Jefferson Democrats living in Pennsylvania and southwestern New York State. And so that was the allegiance he was raised with, and the party activity he began to engage in when Wilson was in the White House, and then during the sort of, for Democrats, wilderness years of the 1920s, Jackson was somewhat less active politically and much more active as a lawyer, and that's really when he built his legal career. But then the tide obviously turned, and the Roosevelt wave, 1933 forward, is part of what he is, you know, really at the core of. He knew Roosevelt from Albany, from Roosevelt's time first as a state senator and then as governor of New York. And so New York Democratic politics become national Democratic politics, and Jackson becomes one of those core New Dealers who are at the foot of the president's bed every morning and in the Oval Office late every night, planning, drafting, tweaking, politicking, and dramatically changing the country during those years.
Yeah. And this relationship stretches over decades. What was the year they first met?
They first met in 1911.
Yeah.
Jackson was 19 years old. He was an apprentice to a local lawyer in Jamestown, New York. Jackson having graduated from high school and never attended college. Certainly he, I think, will be the last Supreme Court justice we ever had who wasn't a college graduate. And Roosevelt was a 29-year-old freshman state senator. And the lawyer who Jackson was apprenticing for took his boy Jackson along to Albany on some political business and introduced him to this young, handsome, but certainly not anything special, state senator. And from that acquaintance begins a pattern of interactions. Gradually they get to know each other. They're really quite well acquainted by the end of the teens, when Roosevelt is Wilson's Assistant Secretary of the Navy and Jackson is a young lawyer. Then Roosevelt gets polio and spends about 4 years really focusing on his health and trying to relearn to walk. And then Jackson is there when Roosevelt returns to the political scene, and he's involved in task forces and special projects for Roosevelt when he's governor from 1929 through 1932. And then he's persuaded to relocate his family, and he comes to Washington in early 1934.
Yeah. What does Robert Jackson have to say about the development of FDR? as a political animal and as a leader from state senator to president?
Well, it's interesting. So few of the people who became core Roosevelt persons during the presidency had the span that Jackson had. So he was really able to do a before and after. Francis Perkins, the Secretary of Labor, was one other who went way back with Roosevelt, but not as far back as Jackson did. And Jackson said that the Roosevelt he met and observed in 1911, 12, 13, 14, was genial, was charming, was handsome. For political purposes, he obviously had a heck of a surname. His distant cousin, Theodore Roosevelt, although a Republican, was still a revered national figure, and that was part of what got Roosevelt elected in the first place to the state Senate. And that, in Jackson's view, no one who knew Roosevelt then, even with the name, would have thought about him as presidential material. And probably he wasn't, Jackson writes. Mm-hmm. But over the next couple of decades, and obviously seriously transformed by his polio experience, Franklin Roosevelt became the man for the moment when the Great Depression guaranteed that whoever the nominee was would become a Democratic president in 1933. Mm-hmm. And then Roosevelt, with a single-minded focus, pursued those two mature challenges of his presidency, the first two terms dedicated to the economy and the third term and the first couple of months before his death and the fourth term dedicated to the war. And you couldn't have a bigger challenge and you couldn't have a bigger figure there to meet that challenge in Jackson's view. And Jackson's amused and a little bit puzzled to think about the 29-year-old he met in Albany in 1911 becoming that great national figure in the 30s and 40s. But he saw it happen.
That man. Of course, that man was how those who hated Roosevelt and his New Deal referred to the president. What can you tell us about the genesis of that nickname? And of course, eventually it is embraced by the president's supporters, including, obviously, Robert Jackson. That's the title he gave the memoir.
That's right. It's very much a pun by the time Jackson was writing this in the 50s. You know, the voters had already had their say, and history was obviously having its say. And although a segment of the country loathed Roosevelt and couldn't even speak his name and referred to him as that man in the White House, that was a minority sentiment, and that's what Jackson's playing off of with the title. The phrase seems to have predated Roosevelt a little bit. It was used by Walter White, the secretary of the NAACP, to refer to Herbert Hoover during the 20s. He called him that man in the Lily White House, which obviously went to the racial policies of that time. And then it got picked up. It's not clear who really coined it first, but it's all over the national papers by 1933, 1934, certainly in 1935. And it's an odd coalition. There were many groups that were hostile to Franklin Roosevelt. Some were corporate capitalist interests who didn't like the tax increases, opponents of big government, isolationists, American racists who didn't like the opening up that was part of Roosevelt's leadership, or capital interests who didn't like the opening up to labor that was part of Roosevelt's program. For all of them, their opposition got this nice little moniker, and it became a very effective shorthand.
Well, at the close of your introduction to this book, you say to read Jackson's manuscript today and learn of its FDR is, you believe, to be struck by his direct relevance to the majority of us who never knew that man. And for me, the relevance really hits hard when I read about what Jackson has to say about Pearl Harbor and the president's reaction.
Absolutely. The figure of Franklin Roosevelt for most people today is not a direct experience. It's a piece of our history. It's a monument. It's a face on the dime. It's a beautiful national monument just below the mall in Washington, D.C., but it's not a living, breathing, in the thick of major issues figure the way it was for people who lived then. We know how it turned out. We know that the Depression was defeated. We know that the Nazis were defeated. For Roosevelt and for Jackson at his side during these years, they're facing enormous challenges, and in a haunting way. This really wasn't so clear at the time I first got access to this file, but after 9/11, in a very haunting way, their challenges are our challenges. There are enemies out there who have struck us and wounded us, and there are challenges that the nation, in trying to secure itself, now faces that come into very complicated clashes with our civil liberties, our traditions of an open and free society. Well, that's kind of exactly what 1939, 40, 41, and then certainly the morning of Pearl Harbor was all about. And, you know, they were as stunned, as shocked, as poorly advised, and as energetically reactive back then as our president was in 2001, as we as a people have been for the last couple of years. So it's not just a history book. It gives you a live Franklin Roosevelt in the middle of stuff that is very much like our challenges today.
Yeah. Jackson writes about the huge failures of American intelligence at this time, which is pretty stunning to read how he puts it. I hope you have the book there, and maybe you would share this passage with us. It's on page 105.
Sure. Jackson had been in the cabinet since January of 1940. And so for 18 months before he goes to the Supreme Court in the summer of 1941, he's there when the Secretary of War, then a cabinet position, the Secretary of Navy, then a cabinet position, are briefing the president about these offshore predictable enemies, both in Europe and in the Pacific. And they didn't get anything like what came to pass. Jackson writes it this way: "I had heard in cabinet discussions the views that had come from our intelligence services. We had enormously underestimated the strength and striking power of Hitler. We had overestimated the staying power of France. We had overestimated the strength of England. We had overestimated the attitude and stamina of Belgium. We had terribly underestimated Japan, at least her immediate striking power. We had terribly underestimated the power of Russia. When she was attacked by Hitler, I heard the highest military authority say, and the common expression around Washington was, that the German armies would move through Russia like a hot knife through butter. I heard General Marshall express the most doubtful views of the power of the Russians to resist. The conquest of Russia was expected to be a very short matter. Based on that information, it was a very dark prospect indeed. I was very pessimistic about it. It looked like a very long war, and a war that would be terrifically costly in lives, because Hitler would have to be dislodged from the position he held, and we had to wage the war of attack. The foolish optimism that had prevailed, such as the invincibility of the American Navy and this and that, all went out of Washington very fast. It was a place of very deep pessimism."
Yeah. Also, it is interesting to me to see that Robert Jackson was a man who thought that the country could have done more in the Philippines at this time.
Yes.
Which, of course, was a disaster.
Yes. Well, I think Roosevelt's optimism was there till the morning of Pearl Harbor itself. He thought a war with Europe, with Germany, was inevitable, and that's what aiding Britain in 1940 is a piece of. He thought somehow something would spare us conflict with Japan, or if conflict came, it would at least be way out in the Pacific theater and something relatively minor, not the devastating Pearl Harbor type strike that we experienced. And the Philippines was another place where the intelligence had been incredibly overly optimistic. The Navy and the American governors had been reporting back to the White House tremendous security situation, preparedness, and so forth. And of course, following Pearl Harbor, Japan rolled up the Philippines very easily and devastated American forces there too. So it's a little bit less appreciated by the public, certainly the public today, but Pearl Harbor was the first punch. The Philippines was the second very hard, very painful punch.
Yeah, and it came so on the heels of Pearl Harbor.
That's right.
Would you share with our listeners Jackson's thinking, his assessment of Roosevelt as a wartime president?
Well, Roosevelt was really quite single-minded, and in that clash I referred to between security issues and liberties, Roosevelt was really quite hard and security-minded. In fact, Jackson, who at that point was Attorney General and then a new Supreme Court justice, was generally much more liberal on liberty issues than Roosevelt turned out to be. For example, Roosevelt wanted to deal with aliens, immigrants in the United States as a law enforcement and investigation issue by moving the Immigration Service out of the Labor Department, where it had been located, because it was viewed as kind of a workforce question, into the Justice Department, so that J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI and Jackson as Attorney General could be on top of who were these German immigrants and Italian immigrants and communists in the United States who were likely to be loyal to our enemies once that European war came. And Jackson argued at great length, but unsuccessfully, that this was an unfair stigma on aliens. It was an improper criminalizing, at least in mentality, of a status, and that it should be handled in some other way other than putting it right under the Justice Department. Roosevelt didn't hesitate. He just, as Jackson said, heard him out and then slid an order across the table during a lunch one day that showed Jackson that he had directed that the INS be moved into the Justice Department. And then, as Jackson writes, he looked across his soup and left the move to me. You know, Jackson stayed and served, but that was one instance. Another was wiretapping. The Department of Justice, J. Edgar Hoover in the FBI, was very aggressive about wiretapping in the late 1930s. Jackson, as Attorney General, shuts that down, and Hoover goes over Jackson's head, appeals to Roosevelt, and Roosevelt generally overrules Jackson and says, for national security interests, we're going to be on the line listening into a lot of phone calls without any particular basis. We're just going to do it because the risk, the security risk, is too great. And there are many other instances, but Franklin Roosevelt, liberal Democratic president, on these security issues was a security president.
Yeah. Also, it's interesting to note that Jackson, as you point out in your introduction, drew particular attention by dissenting from the court's decision. This was when he was on the Supreme Court, to uphold the military order following Pearl Harbor that excluded all persons of Japanese ancestry from West Coast areas.
Yes. Jackson's one of the three dissenters in that case, Korematsu versus United States, which was the Supreme Court upholding the constitutionality of the exclusion order piece of the internment system that treated more than 100,000 Japanese Americans as suspect based only on ethnicity. And, of course, hugely dislocated and, in many cases, destroyed their lives by relocating them off the West Coast. Jackson dissented in that case, and that is him dissenting from a policy of his president and hero and great benefactor, Franklin Roosevelt. And I think that's one of the reasons Jackson's perspective is particularly interesting and powerful. He loved Franklin Roosevelt, and Franklin Roosevelt made Robert Jackson's life and career, the public phase at least, happen. Yet, throughout their relations, Jackson's not afraid to take Roosevelt on. When he's a subordinate, he obviously argues and then often loses on things like wiretapping and the INS. When he's on the Supreme Court, in a very tough circumstance, he does what his job requires, which is to call the constitutional question as he saw it. That we don't make criminal procedure in this country based on race. And so it was a painful decision for Jackson because it involved Roosevelt and military policy. But it was really an easy case because it involved the Constitution.
Mm. So this manuscript, that man, then I think we can fairly assume that, you know, it's a pretty objective look.
Yeah, it really is. He has a great vantage point, and there are lots of moments that he uniquely experienced, and so he's able to recount. And many of them are very positive. And Roosevelt comes out of this book overall as an extremely attractive, capable figure. But he's not perfect, and this is not a biography of a saint. Jackson, for instance, as I said earlier, was a real lawyer's lawyer. And Franklin Roosevelt, although he was a member of the bar and had practiced law, and although he dealt with lots of legal issues in his public life, didn't measure up very well in Jackson's view as a lawyer. He didn't have an understanding of the law. He didn't have a patience for the process that the law is based on. he would sort of see a problem and an objective, a solution he wanted to get to, and wave his hand at the technicalities. But of course, you know, the technicalities are things like sometimes the Constitution. So not much of a lawyer is one of the perspectives that Jackson gives us on Roosevelt. Another perspective is about Roosevelt as an economist. Jackson said that Roosevelt never really worked out because he thinks he didn't really understand deeply in his own mind a theory of the government's place in the economy. Is it the government's job simply to police distortions and stop anti-competitive behavior and monopolization and then let free market forces achieve what they'll achieve? Or is it the government's place to participate, to regulate, to manage the economy? Different parts of the New Deal reflected each of those two philosophies, which are fundamentally inconsistent. And Jackson said that's really because Roosevelt, in his mind, would go back and forth and say, well, couldn't we do both? Demonstrating not a great grasp of economics.
Yeah.
But what Jackson's also saying is that some of these failings in particular roles and moments are not very important overall. In the scheme of things, the greatness of Roosevelt can weather his weakness as a lawyer or his weakness as an administrator or an economist. The clarity of vision, the nobility of character, the decency of the person transcends a lot of the failings that are maybe more technical in nature.
Yeah, it seems that what comes through is Roosevelt is a man who's interested in issues right and wrong, and also of being a leader of all the citizens.
That's right. And he really changed the country, or the country changed, and he was its leader during the change from really a very Republican, free economic behavior, small national government country to a country where the national government was deeply involved in trying to improve the average guy's circumstances through jobs, through unemployment compensation, through the draft, through the war, lots of different ways. And all of that was incredibly popular in a country where 20 years earlier it would have been unthinkable. And Franklin Roosevelt somehow is the figure who manages, who leads, who guides, and obviously who benefits from that sea change. He really was uniquely a leader, and he both stayed in front of the people but was careful not to get too far in front of the people, which is probably the key craft of a politician.
Mm-hmm.
He was also just a great communicator, as we know from the fireside chats and many other examples. Roosevelt was the first president of the radio age, and he had an ability in writing his speeches, and Jackson recounts some of the speech writing episodes that he witnessed, Roosevelt's very directly involved, of simplifying his language and thinking about the individual who he's speaking to. It's not a disembodied communication process. It really is Franklin Roosevelt sitting down with you in your living room through the miracle of your radio and talking to you about a problem, about an issue, about an initiative, about something that he and you share as a big concern, and communicating very effectively his best idea about how to approach it. That's obviously what politicians did from the stump in a fashion, but it became different now with electronic media. We're really all still, literally you and I on the radio, but all of us today are in this age of media communication that Roosevelt began and really was the master of.
Yeah, he was one of the first savvy masters of,
that's right,
of media.
And Jackson speculates near the end of the book that he's writing in 1953 that Roosevelt probably would have been similarly effective with the newly invented television, is what Jackson calls it. And of course, it's interesting to think what Roosevelt would have been like as a TV age president.
Yeah. It is interesting to think about that, because in the photographs he comes through really well,
yeah,
in the stills and in old newsreel footage. So I don't know. That's interesting to think about, isn't
right.
it?
Right, although it was all quite carefully managed,
sure,
so that his his inability to walk would not be portrayed very much. You know, often he's seated, he's in the back of a convertible, or he's in a chair on a stage, or he's standing at a lectern holding the arm of his military assistant or one of his sons. But it's not rolling footage of the physical struggles. And mm-hmm. Franklin Roosevelt's life was, from 1921 forward, filled with a painful physical struggle.
Yeah. On the other hand, today, you know, the images are very carefully staged manipulated. The curtain goes up and the cameras roll, or the video rolls, or whatever. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is John Barrett. He is professor of law at St. John's University in New York. He's also a fellow at the Robert H. Jackson Center in Jamestown, New York. He has edited a manuscript that Robert H. Jackson began working on in the early 1950s. He began writing a memoir of President Roosevelt, but he didn't complete it before his death in 1954. So the manuscript was discovered, or I guess we could say rediscovered, by John Barrett. And John Barrett edited the material, and the result is the book That Man, An Insider's Portrait of Franklin D. Roosevelt. The book is published by Oxford University Press. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon. You can join the discussion with a question, a comment. The numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, what was Robert H. Jackson's thinking about Roosevelt's plan to pack the court in the late 30s?
Well, Roosevelt had an enormous Supreme Court problem in his first term. That's the backdrop. There's a majority in the Congress that is passing New Deal legislation, and Roosevelt is signing a huge quantity and a huge range of experimental statutes into law. And after a year or more, they come to be challenged in various ways in the Supreme Court. And a working majority, sometimes only five, sometimes six justices, start to strike down the New Deal. And they're doing so in the name of a very narrow view of Congress's power to regulate commerce, for instance. And it's really, I think, a sort of economic value, a political value that the justices were imposing in the name of the Constitution. So it was something of a runaway court getting in the way of the elected branches of government. In 1936, Roosevelt is overwhelmingly elected. Through that point, the biggest landslide in American history. Landon wins only Maine and Vermont. And Roosevelt, with his new mandate and his even bigger majorities in Congress, is feeling quite emboldened in early 1937. He, with a very small group of advisors, comes up with this plan to pack the court. It was a statute that would have encouraged justices to retire, but if they didn't, if justices over age 70 chose to stay on the court, an additional justice would be appointed for each of them. Most of Roosevelt's problem justices were the old fellows, and so if everyone had stayed in place, this would have had the effect of diluting them and adding up to six new justices. So the Supreme Court could have jumped under this law that Roosevelt proposed from 9 to 15 justices. Jackson learned about this by picking up a newspaper on a train station kiosk in Philadelphia. He was returning from a trip, and he quickly saw what everybody in the administration saw, that Roosevelt was running into enormous political opposition despite his majorities. And I think a big part of the problem was that Roosevelt tried to sell the plan with spin rather than truth. And it was a rare episode for him where he really, I think, was too cute and less direct than he needed to be. He said this plan was about helping the aged justices who were falling behind in their work. And that just wasn't true. And it was easily shown that that wasn't true. He with Jackson writing some of his speeches and with Jackson testifying and so forth, went to the true explanation, which was that this was about a court that had, you know, overextended its power and was imposing an economic theory that the Constitution really doesn't contain. And Jackson almost pulls Roosevelt's chestnuts out of the fire, if that's the right phrase. Jackson's testimony before the Senate committee is extremely effective. It's the conservative case for court packing, that it's a way to restrain a court that had sort of run off the rails and was out of control. But in the end, the political sentiment in the country was just much too attached to a nine-justice-sized court. And Roosevelt read the handwriting on the wall and pulled the bill. But Jackson was right there in the trenches. He was a very aggressive, successful fighter for the plan. It's one of the things that endeared him greatly to Roosevelt, and it's in the next year where Roosevelt is beginning to think about what he can do to make Jackson the next president.
Hmm. Let's talk with a listener. We've got a caller waiting to talk with us on the toll-free line in Gibson City. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'm so happy that you are interviewing this gentleman who is editing the book by Robert H. Jackson. I was born in 1930, so I was a child during the Roosevelt administration, and I want to ask about one particular situation that I don't think the historians have commented on very much. And I wonder if this gentleman found in Jackson's memoirs something about that. There has been some discussion at various times about why the USA was so profoundly surprised by the Japanese attack in December of 1941. And looking at history, we note that in September of 1941, Franklin Roosevelt's mother died. He grieved very deeply for his mother through that autumn of 1941. And I'm wondering, is it possible that Franklin Roosevelt was so deeply distracted in his grieving for his mother's death during that autumn that he paid very little attention to events in the Pacific, and therefore it was fairly easy for the Japanese to spring the surprise attack on December 7? Does Mr. Jackson in his memoir say anything about that?
That's a very interesting association of two events, and you're right about the timing. Jackson does not write anything about this, and indeed, although Sarah Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt's mother, was hugely important to him, and I think his grief was profound during those months in the fall of 1941, he wasn't the only person caught unprepared. And what Jackson does describe is the intelligence reporting and the cabinet discussions and the total shock on December 7th. Jackson hears it on his radio as he's writing Supreme Court opinions at home during the afternoon that Pearl Harbor has been attacked. So even if Roosevelt was distracted and the death of his mother might explain his personal blindsided experience, that doesn't explain Robert Jackson, Henry Stimson, George Marshall, Knox, many other people who were all in that cabinet and all were shocked and surprised by Pearl Harbor.
So I gather you're saying that it does not center on Franklin Roosevelt alone. There are all these others who were also blindsided and surprised.
Yes, absolutely. This was a town on a bipartisan basis, but certainly in the administration that was caught way off guard because what happened on that Sunday morning was way beyond the pale of what their intelligence and diplomatic reporting had led them to think was possible.
Thank you so much for that insight. I'll go off the line now.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call. Other questions are invited, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Now, back to those passages in that man as commander-in-chief, the chapter. Jackson writes, I had heard repeatedly in cabinet meetings that a war with the Orient would not amount to much, that our Navy would knock Japan out of the water in no time. I think Secretary of the Navy Frank Knox had said a number of times that it would only take maybe 6 months.
Yeah, that's exactly the context. That's why, you know, not only the toll in Pearl Harbor, but the event itself was so devastating because it called into question all of the military advising and all of the intelligence advising. If they could be that wrong about Japanese strength, you know, what else were they unprepared for and underestimating or misunderestimating?
Yeah, and it turns out they were underestimating what the situation was in Europe and
very much so,
and in Russia.
Right.
We've got another call coming in. Let's go and talk with this listener in Chicago. Line 4, good afternoon.
It's very weak, your signal.
Okay, well, we can hear you, so go ahead.
All right. Well, one of the first things that he did was to repeal the Volstead Act. Does that ring a bell?
Yes, that's right. That's prohibition coming to an end at the start of the Roosevelt administration.
And the other thing that's always puzzled me, and I've been told this many times, when Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin all got together, and who was it that really signed over Eastern Europe to the Russians? Poland, Czechoslovakia, Romania, Hungary, and all that. Has that ever been figured out how that was done?
Well, there's a vast history on the Yalta Conference, particularly in January, February 1945. That is really not something that Jackson was privy to. At that point, he'd been on the court for 3-plus years. Roosevelt was actually preparing to send Jackson to do the Nuremberg Project. Roosevelt didn't live to do it, and so it was Truman who sent Jackson. But Jackson was not a part of the War Council. He was outside the administration. So the Yalta phase, the end of the war, the future of Europe among the Allied powers is not something that Jackson was privy to.
I see. Two enemies that he had was Colonel McCormick of the Tribune and Father Coughlin.
Yes, indeed.
That come up? And I think, that, as I remember, there was an NRA with the Blue Eagle. Was that the one that was thrown out?
Yes, that was one of the pieces of legislation that was struck down by the Supreme Court in 1935. The National Recovery Act and Administration was a highly detailed government regulation of the economy. It was wages and prices and supplies, and the government sort of in partnership with manufacturers fixing the economy, very much not free market behavior, and the Supreme Court struck that down as in violation of the Congress's power and the freedom of contract.
I do remember. The one thing that he will be remembered for was the FDIC. Bank insurance.
Right. Well, Roosevelt takes the oath of office in March of 1933 when the nation is in the middle of a banking crisis. You know, the Depression had many facets, but the banks of the country had to go on holiday. They literally could not cover the withdrawals and so forth. And Roosevelt quickly stabilized that situation, and then over time, depositor insurance is one of the many legacies of the New Deal from which we all benefit.
I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon. This book is about Roosevelt. It's also very much about Robert Jackson.
I don't think he overplays himself, but unavoidably, as he's describing that man and his experiences with that man, he's the other person in the room.
Yeah.
And Jackson, in his writing, in this book, in his other books, in his Supreme Court opinions, is very much a biographical writer. The words are the man. They are his own experiences. And so you really do get a feel for him.
Yeah. And you found this manuscript or while doing research for a biography of the justice.
Yes, I'm in progress and working on that. It's probably about 2 years until I'm done. But Jackson's life is really American history, the sort of change from a pioneer agrarian country to the modern world in one man's life, and has these many interesting phases. Roosevelt is really only a piece of it. New Deal, the Supreme Court, Nuremberg, the Nazis, and law practice in rural America back at the beginning is all part of the Jackson story. Yeah.
Well, I look very much forward to reading more about Jackson on the court and also Jackson at Nuremberg. Jackson sat on the court until his death in 1954, and although he'd been very ill, he was on the bench for the unanimous Brown decision.
Yes, we're coming up on the 50th anniversary.
Right.
Jackson had a major heart attack March 30, 1954, and went to the hospital and almost died, and then this was before they even contemplated surgery, didn't know how to do bypasses. So it was a rest cure under close supervision. And he was in the hospital during the drafting phase. Chief Justice Warren came to visit him regularly, and Jackson had lots of input. And then to physically demonstrate the unanimity of the court as it struck down school segregation, Jackson went directly from his hospital bed on May 17th to the Supreme Court. And I've talked to numerous people who were there. They report that on that morning, as the justices stepped up through the curtain to take their seats on the bench, and for the first time in almost 2 months, there was Jackson. The buzz just explodes across the courtroom, and everybody realized that this must be the day. It must be because they're about to decide the segregation case. And Jackson was one of those 9 unanimous judges in Brown versus Board of Education.
Yeah. We have to wrap up here, but maybe you would say something very briefly about the input he had on that decision.
Well, Jackson was, as he demonstrated back in the court packing days, somebody who was cautious about the court and really believed in the political branches. In the Brown case, he became convinced that segregation was one of those so fundamentally evil matters that the court had to step out in front. It couldn't wait for Congress. It couldn't wait for the president. And he was a great admirer of the advocacy of Thurgood Marshall. He thought Thurgood Marshall winning that case had really done it at the podium. And Thurgood Marshall himself was part of the argument for Robert Jackson. His brilliance demonstrated to Jackson that this country was ready to shake off the mistake of Plessy versus Ferguson, of separate but equal, that the races were entirely equal and these legal impediments to that reality needed to be cleared out by the court.
There we have to leave it. I want to thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, thank you, Celeste. It's really been my pleasure.
John Q. Barrett is the editor of That Man, An Insider's Portrait of Franklin D. Roosevelt, a memoir of FDR by the Supreme Court Justice Robert H. Jackson. The book is published by Oxford University Press. And that interview was conducted on January 23rd, 2004. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Standing by with prices from the Chicago Board of Trade, the highs, lows, and settlements, Todd Gleason. Todd?
Thanks, Celeste. In Chicago, if the traders aren't tired already for the week, they probably will be by the time tomorrow finishes up. Another big day at the Chicago Board of Trade. Actually, quite a bit of trading going on. Not particularly low volume today. And futures managed some pretty wide swings for the day. Futures in the bean pit were up 13 to 22 cents for the day. The meal up 5.10 there. The corn futures were up anywhere between 5 and 6 cents. All bidding, trying to get acres from farmers as they get ready to plant this season in hopes that there'll be enough corn and soybeans by the time we get to next fall to continue to meet needs through the following season. Now let's begin in the wheat pit for the day. Futures there finished like this. They were up 8.5 cents in that nearby contract. Had a high today of 374.5, a low at 364.5, a settlement price 373, bouncing off that low end of the trading range. Finished the day 8.5 cents higher. July contract 377, the high, the low at 369, a settlement price at 376.5, up 8.75. In September wheat, 381, the high, the low at 373, a settlement price at 379.5, up 7.5 cents. December wheat, 389, the high, the low at 383, a settlement price there, 388.5, up 7. And the March contract, 390.5, the high, the low at 387, settled 390.5, up 4.5 cents. From the corn pit, up 6.25 cents in the nearby May contract, a high today of 308, a low at 303.75, settled 307.5. Once again, that May contract up 6.25 cents in the corn pit. July futures, 311.5 at the Board of Trade, with the high, the low at 307.25, settlement price 311.25, up 6.5. September 303, the high, 303.5, the high, the low at $3 even, settlement price at 303.25, up 5.5 cents. And your December, $3.5, the high, the low at 296.75, settled just a half cent off the high at $3 even, up 5.25 for that new crop December. March futures in the corn pit, $3.5 for the high, the low at 297, a settlement price there, $3 even, up 4.75 in the May. 301.25 high, low at 299, a settlement 301.25, they finished the day 4.25 higher. July futures in the corn pit, 301.5, the high, the low at 299, settlement price at 301.25, up 4.25, and 2 years out, December 05 corn, 268, the high, the low at 266, a settlement price at 267.5, there's a penny and a half higher there for the day. The May oats now, 164, the high, the low at 161, a settlement price at 163.75, up 2.25. And July oat futures, 168, the high, the low at 165, a settlement price at 167.75, they finished the day 3 higher. From the soy complex, a lot of action happening there for the day. The May futures, jumping up to 15.5-year highs for the day. New contract highs in the corn and the bean pits, by the way. 981 the high for the day in the beans and the May contract, a low at 968, a settlement price at 978.25. They finished 22.5 cents higher. July futures 968 the high, the low at 954, a settlement price at 966.25, up 24.75. August futures 920 the high, the low at 908, settlement price at 919, up 22.5 cents for the day. In the September beans, 833 the high, the low at 824, settlement price at 830.5. They were up 15 on the day. November's contract 754.25 the high, the low at 744.5, a settlement price at 752. They're up 13.25. In the January soybean, 751 the high, the low at 745, a settlement price at 750. They're up 12 on the day. March futures in the bean pit, 745 the high, the low at 737, and a settlement price there at 744 and one half. They were up 11.5 cents. The May soybean meal now, 299.30 the high, the low at 296, a settlement price at 297.80, up 510. And July meal, 295.50 the high, the low at 292, a settlement price at 294.10, up 570. May bean oil, 33.83 the high, the low at 33.15, a settlement price 33.75, up 70. And the July contract, 33.59 the high, the low at 32.98, settlement there 33.57. They finished 70 higher for the day. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you, Todd. March feeder cattle, 89.85, the high 89.55, the low 89.85, the settlement that up 5. April, 88.45, the high 87.52.5, the low 87.95, the settlement that down 42.5. May, 87.40, the high 86.50, the low 86.80, the settlement that down 42.5. August, 88.60, the high 87.95, the low 88.07.5, the settlement that down 67.5. March live cattle, 85.30, the high 84.50, the low 85.10, the settlement that down 5. April, 81.55, the high 80.40, the low 80.85, the settlement that down 55. June, 76.45, the high 75.60, the low 75.97.5, the settlement that up 10. August, 74.75, the high 73.95, the low 74.42.5, the settlement that down 10. April lean hog, 64.85, the high 63.75, the low 64.12.5, the settlement that down 20. May, 64.30, the high 63.20, the low 63.50, the final price that down 42.5. June, 70.10, the high 68.90, the low 69.32.5, the settlement down 37.5. July, 65.95, the high 65.07.5, the low 65.82.5, the settlement that up 10. March bellies, 97.10, the high 96.10, the low 96.70, the settlement that down 102.5. May, 97.20, the high 96.12.5, the settlement 96.45, the settlement that down 105.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Verde Gallery and Verdant News and Coffee, 17 East Taylor Street in downtown Champaign, a place of inspirations where community and culture converge. Verde Gallery is currently showing Distant Voices Nearer, a celebration of American Indian art.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Ron J. Pieper from Iowa City writes, "Dear Dr. Science, what's the difference between an engineer